Yeah, so York was in fact an experiment for us in mode of living as much as testing some alternative creative outlets. I decided after a year that pottery wasn't my bag, and we'd started doing things like driving into the city just to see movies. And I was doing a little bit of teaching at that time. I was teaching at the Fremantle Alternative School under Gary Burke, and I started doing a little bit of tutoring at the university in architecture. And from there I started doing a little bit of architectural work with a colleague at the university. And it gradually got me back into practice. So not that I was that experienced in practice at that stage, but it got me back into it. We're working okay here?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And I decided that I would test my interest in the visual arts a little more seriously and enrolled in a few courses at what was then the Perth Tech Art School, and then moved on from there to what was then the West Australian Institute of Technology Art School, which was the premier art school in Perth then. And found myself drawn to printmaking as a medium because it involved drawing, which I was reasonably capable of. And I was fascinated by the kind of archaic techniques of printmaking too. So I did a degree in printmaking, majored in it. Did painting also, and finished that and went on to a postgraduate degree in fine arts because I'd been also drawn to the art history and theory area. And there was a very good guy teaching at Waite Curtin, by the name of Bruce Adams. And Bruce and I got on very well. He had me doing some tutoring for him in the art history when he had to spend time away. And so I did a postgraduate diploma in fine arts. And I then applied for and won a fellowship that was on offer, offered by Channel 7, Carruthers. It was a Carruthers
fellowship. Sir James Carruthers.
It was Sir James Carruthers fellowship that he offered to people working in the arts.
Ah.
And it was a very generous fellowship, and it allowed me to go and live in New York on my own for several months and just to test the waters and reevaluate where I was heading, because I had to make a choice whether I'd go down the path of fine arts or go down the path of architecture. And I thought New York was a great place to kind of test that.
Work through it.
Because it is the most astonishing built stage set, occupied stage set. It's the most urban place on earth. And I fell in love with it from day one.
Yes.
And spent all my time exploring both the architectural and the visual art possibilities. It was the time of graffiti moving from the trains to the galleries, and all of those very early graffiti expressionist artists like Basquiat, etc. So it was a fascinating time to be in New York. And New York was, this was still grunge New York, pre-Giuliani.
Yes.
And there were terrifying moments as well as the most exhilarating moments.
Yeah. So I'm guessing of that experience that took you, in a sense, back or confirmed your commitment to architecture.
It did. I retain my interest in the visual arts, but have never kind of seriously returned to practice since that time. I came back to what was a part-time position at the University of Western Australia, which became shortly after a full-time position. And really devoted myself over that period to exploring what the teaching could become.
Yes.
And after a couple more years doing that, I went to England and This was in the time when universities were a bit different from what they are now. And I remember there being a man in human resources, his name was Galbraith from memory, who I went and chatted to and said, listen, there's this opportunity. It was America's Cup time here. There's this opportunity to go to London, and I'm not interested in being around all this America's Cup stuff. I would love to do this course. And it was at what is still called the Architectural Association School of Architecture, which was and still is known as one of the best programs in architecture in the world. And it's a privately run program. It's not involved with any state institution or any university for that matter. And I'd only been teaching at the University of WA for, I don't think it was even 2 years full time. And he said, look, if you're committed to doing this and if you're committed to paying the fees, which I was, I'd saved for that purpose, we're willing to take the punt with you and we'll give you study leave. So off I went with my family. I had two little kids by then. And we lived in London for an academic year and I took on that course. And it, like that period in New York and the period travelling, was pretty life-changing. And it enabled me to come back to the course at UWA with some much firmer ideas about where the program could be taken.
What you wanted to do, presumably, what you wanted to write about.
Well, what I thought was an appropriate way to shift the program. And yeah, what I wanted to do architecturally and where my research interests lay.
Here we are in Fremantle, as I said at the very outset. You live in Fremantle.
Yep.
When did you first start living in Fremantle?
I actually first came to Fremantle as a child. My parents shifted here from a suburban setting in 1958 when I was 10. And we lived here for 4 years. And for me, it was like liberation. being taken out of a kind of normative, conventional setting in the suburbs to Fremantle, where I was living in communities of people who couldn't speak English very well. There were Italians, there were Yugoslavs, there were Portuguese. There was a functioning harbour with sailors and pubs, and I loved doing things like selling the daily newspaper, doing the rounds in the pubs and becoming a regular, visiting all the people along the way. It was all great fun. And when it came time to kind of get a place of our own, Fremantle loomed as the only place for serious consideration after the experience of York.
Yes.
So we bought this little, well, this terrace house that we still live in 40 odd years later.
40 years later.
Yeah.
Let me jump to a couple of what seemed to me, looking from a distance at your career highlights, to be important ones. You're appointed the WA Young Mid Architect back, in the early 2000s?
Yeah, the end of 2003, I took on that role.
What was the role? Did it turn out to be the same as it was sold, or as you envisaged?
What had happened, I guess, as a result of various state governments aligning themselves with Thatcherite economics, the once terrific institution of the old Public Works Department was disbanded or reduced significantly from what it was. And whereas all government buildings had been designed and their construction managed through what was the Public Works Department, it was all sent out to the private sector. After a while, people started asking questions about the quality of the work they were getting, because the old Public Works Department produced some terrifically high quality work, and it was done very carefully, very professionally, all watched, and it was a training ground for young architects, young engineers, young surveyors, etc. And it was a great training ground, and that possibility vanished with all the political changes that occurred. So really the role of government architect was established back at that time, the early 2000s, to try and encourage and put in place processes that would reintroduce quality to the work that was being delivered for government, the building work that was being delivered for government. So that was really the task, to develop policy, to develop processes.
Was that an overview role, or are you sort of generating architectural plans?
We did get involved with some broad planning exercises, but really it was overview and offering review of projects as they were developing, proposing processes that would foreground design rather than make it a kind of add-on that could just as easily be cut off. And at that time, we had some very good models in other parts of the world to look at, the most impressive of which was the Commission for Architecture and the Built Environment in London, which had been set up under a Labor government and was at its peak, really, peak of power and peak of policy development at that time that I took on that role.
Right.
So I very quickly took myself off to London and sat in on a lot of what they did, met the right people and talked to them.
Yes.
And was able to learn from those processes that they'd developed.
Did you enjoy the role? I'm guessing you did.
Yeah, I thought the role was both challenging and put me on the steepest learning curve I've ever been on. I came across in those first few weeks, maybe months, acronyms that I had no idea about, and so I had to just fudge my way through it.
Nothing like an acronym.
Yeah, that's right. But yeah, I did enjoy the role. You make enemies along the way in that kind of role, but you learn to get a bit thick-skinned.
Well, it's my experience. Sociologists and prehistorians who seem to make lots of enemies amongst themselves, but I guess when you're dealing with any creative activity, and architecture's one, not everyone holds the same view of beauty, I suppose.
Well, it's not even beauty. It's a whole range of issues that you bring to a review type role, because reviewing a design is rarely about the look of the building, the aesthetics. It has to do with a whole range of other factors. And again, that's where the CABE, the Commission for Architecture and the Built Environment in London, was so valuable, because they attempted to articulate and make measurable some of those aspects of evaluation.
And so I'm taking it from that, if one can do that in a formal way and articulate it, see it carried into effect, then proponents of developments who come afterwards, in a sense, know what the ground rules are.
Yeah, I think it's important to be able to put in front of someone who's submitting a proposal for review, these are the ground rules.
Yes.
These are the issues that we're looking at.
Yes.
And this is how we'll be reporting back to you.
So I'm taking it from what you've said, Geoffrey, that sort of overview involving design, looking at all of those characteristics, preconditions, attributes of a built development, were relatively new here in Western Australia at the time you undertook this.
Yes, they were. As a result, some architects were dragged to the table screaming, how dare you put me through this process? I caricature, of course, but
yes,
there were some who were quite resistant.
Couldn't
to
quite
that
see
process.
Why their capacities needed to be second-guessed, I suppose.
Yeah, how their judgment could be questioned.
You then went on to perform what I'm guessing is a similar role, because it has a similar description to it, in Victoria, Victorian government architect.
Yeah, I spent 5 years in the role here in Western Australia, and I think in a role like that, I think it has a limited life for an individual.
Probably for all the reasons you've just
intimated. Yeah, for a whole host of reasons. And I was flattered to be invited to apply for the role in Victoria, which I did, and was successful, and was in that role for bit longer. It was about 6.5 years. And again, towards the end of that, I felt I was spinning my wheels a little, and I'd come across a minister who I found difficult to work with, and thought it was
time to do other things.
Time to leave, let someone else take that one on. But yeah, in that role, there was a kind of, when I arrived, there was an informal process of design review, which occurred much like what we'd initiated here. But I thought it would be useful to put in place a much more formalised process along the lines of what CAVE had done in London. So we initiated the Victorian Design Review Panel, which has gone on now to strengths.
It was my next question, really, to ask you whether concept, perhaps as an evolved concept, is now to be found alive and well throughout the Commonwealth of Australia.
Both the concept of government architect and the concept of design review panels is very alive and well throughout Australia. I think Tasmania is the only part of Australia that doesn't have in place a government architect. They did have one for a period, but they allowed the position to lapse.
Now, design review panels are, of course, also to be found in local government and local planning and development application worlds, and I think you've been, maybe you've just finished for about 10 years, heading, I think, the City of Fremantle advisory panel, is that right?
Yes, the City of Fremantle began its design advisory committee 10 years ago, and I applied to be part of that. And was nominated as the chair, and I've sat in that position for the full 10 years and just concluded my last meeting about a week ago.
Congratulations. It's nice to come across someone who's just retired, like I have not so long ago, from something. a new world lies ahead. Now, tell me about that role in a place like Fremantle.
Yeah.
People of Fremantle, myself included, we can all get bolshy about all sorts of things. We have people in the West End who are very concerned about anything that might affect the quality of it. We have every imaginable sort of social and planning and economic issue floating around in Fremantle. It's, to be on a design advisory panel like you, where it must have had its moments.
It did. And it will continue to have its moments. I mean, Fremantle is a pretty precious place, and there are many, many aspects that we've got to be very careful about. But I think we also have to be careful that it doesn't descend into a kind of moribund museum state. We need to encourage development of a good sort, and we need to help guide that development to become better than what it might otherwise be through that process of design review. What we also need to understand is that the people who are on that design advisory committee are not actually designing. They're working with what is put in front of them and trying to encourage improvement to it. We're also advisory only. We don't have any kind of statutory role.
Have you ever fully explored the role of the panels as they exist around the state? And of course a lot's happened in the planning approval system over the relatively recent years. And you've got the body with the acronym JDAP.
That's right.
People know what a JDAP is. If you tell them the full name, they don't. Mm. You've got the council itself and its planning committee making decisions as well. You've got the advisory panel, which is part of the city structure as I understand it. Does the council have to, under its own rules, regard the advice that come from the panel?
No, as I say, we are advisory.
Yes.
And the council can choose to ignore what we have to say. It has to be said, though, that the council... there was a period of kind of learning about one another, but I think the council has been very respectful of the views that the Design Advisory Committee has put forward. And I'd like to think that it's given them some confidence about some tough decisions they've had to make along the way. The The design advisory committee, the structuring of the design advisory committee coincided with some pretty important changes in the city of Fremantle. There was Amendment 49, which encouraged the possibility of additional height and building area if there was, if the scheme was associated with design excellence. So there needed to be some process in place that could assess what design excellence might be. And that has had some interesting some interesting conflicts along the way, as you might imagine.
And in practical terms,
yeah,
for those of you, and the chair probably in a more onerous position, what sort of commitment, what sort of involvement, how many days and nights of the week might this take up?
Oh, normally you would meet once, the committee meet once a month.
Yes.
And it's a full half day normally. When the development applications are rolling in, when things are a little slow, you might cancel a meeting or have a shorter meeting. So you're dealing fundamentally with the development applications as they come in, although there may be a policy issue that the city would like some guidance on, and you might meet for an hour or two to discuss that and offer some advice back to the city.
Yes. And have you found it rewarding at no doubt various levels?
Yeah.
Personally, professionally?
I doubt if I would have kept at it for 10 years if I hadn't found it rewarding at some level. It's always interesting to be involved with what is going on in your town and understand where the pressures lie. And it is rewarding to see improvements to project as a result of the input of the committee. And I have to say I've worked with some fantastic people on that committee. It's been a real privilege. And I hope it goes on in that manner.
Just looking at Fremantle, and we'll draw this to an end shortly, but you've lived here for 40 years,
yep,
continuously, as you describe, and you were here when you were younger. You have a sense of Fremantle like very few people. You've seen it go through this and that, from the late 50s through the 60s, the America's Cup much later in the late 80s. It's become a destination for many people. Places like South Fremantle, where parents were worried if their children went to live at one point, and they're much sought after, as is the rest of the municipality.
Yep.
What particular challenges do you see Fremantle is facing now? Are there particular things that worry you or that you'd like to see done?
I think there are some very good bones in place now for Fremantle. What we desperately need, I think, is more people living in the city itself. So that Amendment 49, which was intended to encourage apartment living, particularly along Queen Victoria Street, fell on foul times in terms of the property market. So we can only hope that when we get out of where we are at the moment with COVID-19, that the property market might pick up and the attractions of living in or close to the city of Fremantle will become more apparent to more people. I think we need a real diversity of housing stock, so we encourage a real range of household types in here. We need desperately to look at how we deal with the growing problem of homeless people on our streets. The fact that we've now got the state government having shifted a number of its agencies into new accommodation in Fremantle, I think, is a real positive. Unfortunately, again, the times have not worked for us, and the whole ground floor of that development remains closed up. So the hope is that once things do pick up economically and that all opens up and the new King Square City of Fremantle offices open and that whole precinct becomes a more valued urban place, that Fremantle can start humming again. At the moment, it's in one of its troughs.
Is there anything that you've learned or you think is something you might have learned from your years in architecture that would produce would stimulate the business side of Fremantle. You hear the traders complaining sometimes bitterly about council decisions and things that hold back business. I imagine if one takes a simple market view of the world, you have to let the market sort it out. But is there anything that a built environment can do initially? Is there anything in planning or architectural terms, or more generally, given your overview of Fremantle, that would make its business life more vibrant?
Oh, I'd love to think there's a magic wand that could be applied.
Meaning that there isn't, of course.
I don't believe there is. I think we need to be able to control things like the fact that many buildings are left vacant because their rent requests are so high. I think it would be valuable for the council to have a kind of forum with some of these owners and talk to them about the future of Fremantle is riding to a significant extent, I think, on their willingness to come to the party and charge rents that are at a realistic level that would allow occupation and new businesses to take risks that they feel they can't afford to take because of the level of rents being charged. And there are also landlords who are just leaving properties vacant. They're not interested in all that goes along with being a landlord. And again, that's to the great detriment of the city. I think the city has been doing a pretty good job in establishing for us a good public realm and encouraging good development. Occasionally, some of those controls don't provide what you'd like to see. But in a sense, I'd rather see the city moving forward than...
Are there any particular...
Putting the brakes on.
Yes. Are there any particular parts of the city, and I don't just mean the centre of Fremantle, which you'd love to see something happen on? For example, we're seeing the old Fremantle tech site subject of redevelopment plans at the moment, which seems to have got people in Prospect excited. But are there holes in the city? Are there places that you would just love to see something happen?
I think development on Victoria Quay could be a real plus for the city. And by that, I don't mean supermarkets. I mean mixed use. It'd be great to get a new industry down there. I fully support the concept of getting a film industry precinct operating on Victoria Quay. I think that would be a wonderful bonus to the city. And I think all the add-ons that it could provide to the town could be wonderful. There is difficulty in getting accommodation on Victoria Quay at the moment. Although I understand short-term accommodation might be acceptable, longer term is not. again, the major issue for me is getting people living in the city, getting the numbers up so we can support and sustain the businesses that operate out of the city, the everyday businesses.
Geoffrey, it's been lovely talking to you. Thank you for sharing reminiscences in some ways from the past. It is interesting to hear how people got to where they are today, and also particularly in the latter part of our discussion talking about Fremantle. And enjoy your continued life here.
Thank you, Mario.